the collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
I'm Muiza Muntali, host of African Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW, Washington.
From WPFW News in Washington, this is Monday Morning QB, a news program with a point of view. Today is Monday, May 6, 2024. I'm Sue Goodwin.
And I'm Chris Spengert-Grounds. Today on the show, why millions of low-income Americans may soon be paying more to use the internet.
Plus, the Supreme Court considers another way to limit workers' rights.
All that and more. Stay with us.
Millions of low-income Americans are facing the prospect of paying more to access the internet, and some may even lose access completely if they cannot afford to pay more. That's because funding for the Affordable Connectivity Program, or ACP, is set to expire by the end of this month if Congress doesn't take action. The program provides low-income participants up to $30 a month to help them afford broadband internet. Families on tribal lands can receive up to $75 each month to help them afford the internet. To learn more about why this program was established in the first place and what it would take to keep it going, we reached out to Amy Huffman. She is Policy Director at the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, a nonprofit organization that works to close the digital divide and advance digital equity. And just last week, she was named by Government Technology Magazine as one of its 2024 top 25 doers, dreamers, and drivers. And as she explained to us, what makes the work she does, along with her colleagues and others in the digital equity movement, so essential is that reliable internet access is a basic need for families today, on a par with utilities such as water and electricity.
Internet access is a necessity because nearly everything that we do today in 2024 is online or requires some sort of online interaction somewhere along the roads. For example, nearly every organization that you apply for a job, the job applications online, even jobs that are not online jobs like McDonald's and Walmart. And education requires a lot of online applications and internet use, as does healthcare, and I can go on and on. But nearly everything that we do today touches the internet in some form or fashion. And so everyone needs to have it so they can access those benefits.
Yet, despite the importance of this technology, millions of Americans still struggle to stay online for a number of reasons, though one obstacle stands out far more than others.
Yeah, so as somebody who's been in this field for some time, I can tell you that affordability is an issue that until the Affordable Connectivity Program, we nationally just did not have a good solution for. So there's several barriers that keep a person from accessing the internet on a daily basis. And one of them is not having access to the internet at all in their area. And that's a huge barrier that prevents many households across the country from accessing the internet. And then the second biggest barrier, and then actually I think the data show that this might be the bigger barrier, is affordability. So being able to afford what is available to you, if it's available to you, being able to afford it.
According to the White House, more than 23 million households have taken advantage of the $14.2 billion program since it was launched in December of 2021. That's roughly one in six households who now have to raise additional funds to stay connected. The gap between those with and without access to broadband has become known as the digital divide, and the ending of the Affordable Connectivity Program only stands to widen it, despite the potential of the internet to promote equity among Americans in more ways than one.
So the internet, it has the potential to be the great equalizer of our time. It's never been easier to start a business because you can start one online from anywhere in the world. It's never been easier to access your healthcare provider. It's never been easier to do all these things that the internet provides a pathway and an easy on-ramp to doing if you have it, if you actually have the internet and a device and the skills to use it, right? The divide is between those that have those resources and those that don't. And this has been a divide that has existed for a very long time. It has ebbed and flowed, but it does tend to impact vulnerable and disadvantaged populations. So Congress has recognized that, and they included funding in the Infrastructure Act, including the Affordable Connectivity Program, to address this digital divide for what they call covered populations. And those populations are rural, low-income, households of color. The Affordable Connectivity Program primarily serves low-income households, so anyone under 200% of the poverty line, and then those that might be able to access the program through different federal benefit programs. And it also serves households living on tribal lands. And those households are the most vulnerable and disadvantaged households. If you qualify for the program, you're in that category. And so because these folks are already the folks that are unlikely to be able to get online without this assistance, now the program ending, we're going back to square one. And these folks are now going to have to either make really tough decisions on whether to use their fixed income for groceries or the internet or clothing for their kids or the internet, or they'll have to go to great and extreme lengths to access the internet. Like, I just heard of a household in New Mexico where the woman, a woman who receives the benefit, says, okay, well, I guess I'll have to drive 52 miles to the library like I used to do to access the internet. So people will still need the internet, but they'll have barriers put in front of them in order to access it. And the people who won't be able to have it will be the people who, frankly, could use this internet equalizer the most.
So now that the Affordable Connectivity Program is set to end, where do we go from here? In other words, what are the options for families who have come to rely on the discount it provided? One option is that internet service providers will continue to offer low-cost plans that became common under ACP. In fact, based on a federal appeals court ruling last month in Manhattan, New York State will soon require internet providers to charge some low-income residents just $15 a month for internet access. But as Amy Huffman explains, there are limitations to that option.
Yeah, so before the pandemic and before the Affordable Connectivity Program, some providers had what was called a low-cost plan, and it was for households that they would determine what eligibility for that would be, and they would determine an amount and the speeds and the types of internet that they'd offer. There were few and far between. Not every provider had one. Not even all the big major national ones had one. There were different eligibility criteria across the board. And many times the plans were actually like less speeds than what if I paid full price would get. So they were lower quality, in other words. Now, post ACP, during ACP, many providers came forward and offered plans that would fall under this $30 benefit cap. And so therefore many households ended up getting no cost internet between the plans being $30 or less and the benefit being $30 or $75 if you're on tribal land. So in the post ACP world, the Federal Communications Commission is encouraging, but not requiring, encouraging providers to offer these low-cost plans. And we do expect many of them to do so, and particularly the national ones with the national footprint. Many of them have already rolled out what they intend to do. I think Verizon's published something, I believe Comcast as well, and I think we'll see more in the coming days and weeks as we get a clearer sense of what will or won't happen on Capitol Hill. The limitations is it's up to the provider what they will provide. So there's that can be good and that can be not good for low-income households. The eligibility, they'll have to determine what those thresholds are. So that won't be consistent across the board. So that can cause confusion for consumers, can also cause confusion for advocates and people who work with the consumers, the folks that are in our affiliate network. And then the providers are going to have a hard time verifying whether folks are eligible or not, walking a fine line between not collecting too much personal PII, personally identifying information, while also still trying to get at the data to understand who is eligible and who is not and verify that. Right now, the ACP has the Federal Communications Commission that oversees the program, they have a tool that verifies that for the consumer and for the provider. And so that tool won't be available for the providers to use post-ACP. So it's going to be difficult to actually administer these types of programs in a meaningful way. And then some providers just won't, particularly small, rural providers won't be able to afford to offer a low-cost plan because it costs more to deploy in rural areas. And if they're a small provider, they may not have the extra capital that they're getting off of other areas. So the benefit really did help rural and smaller providers genuinely lower their costs for low-income households.
Of course, another option to boost internet affordability for all Americans is for Congress to step in and extend funding for the Affordable Connectivity Program, which is what the Biden White House is calling for, and that is the preferable option for the National Digital Inclusion Alliance, which is also urging Congress to find a more permanent funding solution to our nation's digital divide.
So the program, we believe we need a short-term bridge funding and one-time appropriations from Congress to get us time to get us a long-term solution in place. We, NDIA, believe that long-term solution is within the Universal Service Fund. And so moving the ACP under that umbrella, again, managed by the Federal Communications Commission, and modernizing that fund so that it can afford and provide this benefit moving forward, I think that's a long-term answer. Now, that process is going to take a significant amount of time. So there is a working group at the Senate, actually bicameral, bipartisan working group, working on this issue, and that gives us some hope that there could be progress there. Also, Senator Betterman introduced a bill on this. So hopefully that will, you know, these separate but, you know, aligned issues will move forward in time to make sure that even if we get this funding now, that there's still a program in the future to continue funding through the Universal Service Fund.
Now, it needs to be said that many Americans take internet access for granted and find it relatively easy to include it as part of their monthly expenses. But even when that is the case, that doesn't mean the issue of affordable internet access can't be a priority that all Americans take on and choose to act on. Amy Huffman explains how.
Yeah, I definitely think this is an issue worth, you know, advocating for your friends, for your neighbors, for people in your community who do rely upon this benefit. So I'd encourage folks to first kind of get up to speed and understand what's going on. And they can check out our website. They can check out many other, there's lots of news articles right now that are, people can get up to speed on the issue. And second, call their member of Congress and ask them to fund the program and make sure it continues. And third, to just find ways to support digital inclusion practitioners and the folks that are on the ground supporting these households day in and day out. There's lots of folks around the country that, lots of organizations and small community-based organizations and nonprofits that could use support and help in a number of ways, volunteering or partnership and things like that. So definitely lots of opportunity. This is a big tent. We welcome anyone that wants to jump in and support.
That was Amy Huffman. She is Policy Director at the National Digital Inclusion Alliance. You can find the many resources they make available on this issue of internet affordability and digital equity at www.digitalinclusion.org. That's digitalinclusion.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin. The Supreme Court heard arguments regarding former President Donald Trump's claim that the federal charges accusing him of plotting to overturn his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden must be thrown out because he is immune from being prosecuted for any so-called official act he took as president. A majority of the justices did not appear to embrace his claim of absolute immunity that would necessarily stop Special Counsel Jack Smith's prosecution of Donald Trump. At the same time, several members of the Republican-appointed majority seemed to indicate that some limited form of protection, like the qualified immunity that can apply to other government officials, was needed for Donald Trump and future U.S. presidents. Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Samuel Alito, and Justice Clarence Thomas all raised concerns that without protections, presidents could face politically motivated prosecution for actions they take while in office. Kathy Feng is Vice President of Programs for Common Cause, and she joined us to explain the legal framework for what the Supreme Court is sorting through in this case.
The Supreme Court has a very large question that it is trying to decide. The question isn't just whether there should be immunity granted to a U.S. president, but where to draw the line. And I think that there's a real concern on both sides. On the one side, there is concern that if you don't have some level of immunity, that it could have a chilling effect. But on the other side, the very real concern that we share with Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson is you don't want to remove all checks on criminal behavior because you have the most powerful person in the world who could turn the Oval Office into, as she said, the seat of a criminal enterprise. And we do not want to create an incentive for any candidate to step into office thinking that they can act with entire abandon for our criminal justice system. And so that question about where to draw the line is what the Supreme Court is now struggling with.
And as they do, of course, an election is taking place, which is what led Common Cause to file an amicus brief with the Supreme Court before arguments were heard in Donald Trump v. United States, urging the court to issue a ruling quickly. So if they decide that the former president is not immune in the January 6 case from prosecution over election interference, the district court has sufficient time to hold a trial before the November election. And voters will have a fuller and rightfully deserved sense of his conduct and character.
We don't have a situation very often where somebody who is the candidate is also the former president who is being investigated and now charged with criminal acts of corruption and other violations of the law. And because the candidate currently is being considered by voters, whether to vote for them or some other candidate, it is absolutely important that we have resolution to that case so that voters can make a decision that will affect the next 4 years of America's democracy. in other cases that have involved this kind of important question, and probably the most apt analogy is in the Nixon case in 1974, the court acted very quickly, took a total of 1 month from the minute that they got the request from prosecution and Nixon, all the way to the decision that they ultimately issued about the question of whether prosecution could have access to tape recordings of Nixon's conversations. They took 1 month.
And those tapes enabled the House to vote on Nixon's impeachment, leading to his resignation 2 weeks later. However, even with Nixon as an example of how quickly the Supreme Court can move when it chooses to on charges of alleged misconduct by a president, when it comes to making this decision about Donald Trump's immunity to the charges he currently faces of conspiracy and obstruction, there is already an indication that this case may move at a slower pace. That's because during last week's hearing, the justices focused a great deal of their questioning on definition. In other words, if some level of presidential immunity were to be granted, the question then becomes where to draw the line in order to determine how an official act could be distinguished from a private action that could be subject to prosecution. And even within the context of an official act, at what point is the president to be held accountable for criminal behavior?
If we think that our U.S. president should be able to act in certain official capacity without fear of criminal prosecution, then when would we allow for a criminal prosecution to happen? Where is the line that we would draw? If you frame it that way, then you're going to spend a lot of time talking about what's an official act, what's not an official act, how much criminal activity, evidence of criminal activity do you have to have before you can start to investigate something, even if it falls within the official act. You could say that the official act line makes no sense, right? And it's simply what types of activity constitute prosecutable crimes when it comes to the presidency. And I think that a lot of those questions are probably the types of things that they're struggling with right now. So if the president, for instance, orders military troops to find and kill someone who has been charged with committing acts of terrorism on U.S. soil or ordering acts of terrorism on U.S. soil, how do you distinguish that from ordering the military to find and kill a political opponent? And I'm guessing that that's part of the active conversation that might be happening behind closed doors.
Given what seemed to be a priority by the Supreme Court to ask these kinds of questions before granting immunity, it's entirely possible that the justices say in their ruling that the lower court has to go through each charge against Trump in the four-count indictment and decide if it crosses the bar into prosecution before a trial can take place. This, of course, could add considerable delay to the process and make it increasingly unlikely that Trump's trial on charges of election interference will not happen before the election. Because even if the court did not bump the decision to the lower court and decided the trial actually can go ahead, there's not much more time left for that decision to allow for a trial before November.
If the decision does not come down until June, it does make it very difficult for a trial to take place, partly because the lower court needs to give both parties time to prepare. And once you get into the time frame of September, October, it becomes so close to the elections that prosecution may choose not to pursue the case at that time and delay until after the elections, because there is a standing practice that they don't want to influence the elections that way. So as a matter of course, if the decision comes out sometime in April, even early May, it is still a possibility that the trial could move forward and we could have resolution before the election.
Of course, as we just heard, there is a strong possibility that is not what happens. And given the potential that could have on the democratic process, the amicus briefing filed by Common Cause also carries a warning, which is that a failure to act quickly could open the court to the perception that it is attempting to influence the 2024 election in favor of Trump, which, Kathy Fang says, could undermine the public's faith in the Supreme Court, and that is nothing to be taken lightly.
I think that it's absolutely important that people have trust that one of the pillars of our three branches of government that we all learned from Schoolhouse Rock has the ability to take politics out of the decision and make a speedy decision for the sake of allowing this case to move forward. There is concern that if the Supreme Court simply bows to partisan pressure or has a partisan bias, that they might allow for Trump's delay tactics to essentially succeed by slow walking this case. And that shadow is one that nobody wants to be cast on the Supreme Court.
Especially this Supreme Court, which is already dealing with questions of impartiality when making decisions that could have political impact.
Unfortunately, there has been a swirl of corruption and personal interest and partisan interest around several of the justices. Earlier this year and last year, we had revelations that Justice Thomas had received a lot of favors and support from major donors who also pushed a certain partisan agenda. And his wife was very closely involved with activities that suggested that she was communicating directly with members of the Trump administration about January 6th and the actions around trying to subvert the vote. So there is a real question about whether some of the Supreme Court justices have a conflict of interest. At the same time, there are justices, both conservative and liberal, who very much guard zealously the reputation of the Supreme Court as an entity that can make decisions on behalf of all American people and for justice overall. And that includes, I would say, Chief Justice Roberts. So I think that there is a fair argument that people have about concerns about the interests of certain justices, but also there is an opportunity for the Supreme Court as a whole to act with impartiality on this case in particular, to show that it can decide quickly and decisively around an issue that I think there is not a whole lot of disagreement around. The president does not have absolute immunity. There clearly is a line that can be drawn. There was even agreement between defense counsel and a lot of the questioning coming from justices about where some of those lines could be drawn. They should be able to decide this quickly and allow for the criminal proceedings to make their way to court and trial in time for voters to be able to understand what the outcome is when they're going to the polls in November.
And it's not just the question of absolute immunity that the justices could quickly decide on. They could decide that in this particular case, there is no need for any court to go through the process of questioning whether this case meets any kind of new standards for qualified immunity, because clearly it does not.
They could also just say, you know what, we can't decide all those things, but we can say this universe of things that are before us right now do constitute things that could be prosecutable as a crime, and therefore we're going to order the lower court to move forward, right? That it could be as clear-cut as that and very limited, right? We're not going to decide what's an official act. We're not going to decide what might be prosecutable in a larger sense. What we will decide is that this set of questions that was presented to the lower court do fall within acts that could be prosecutable because they are neither official or they are clearly illegal, if the facts as alleged are true.
In closing, Kathy Fang says that even while this case is eating up an extraordinary amount of attention that could be devoted to any number of other pressing concerns in terms of elections and democracy, there is something to be gained along the way.
You just never expected that we were going to have a president who would actually say that they should be absolutely immune from prosecution. Every single small d democratic norm has been thrown into question. But the silver lining is that the American people are having a hard conversation, and we are deciding together the norms that we need to uphold in order to ensure that our democracy works for all of us.
Kathy Fang is Vice President of Programs for Common Cause. You can read their amicus brief on Trump's immunity claim at commoncause.org. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Late last month, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case pitting coffee giant Starbucks against a federal agency tasked with enforcing worker protections. That agency, called the National Labor Relations Board, ruled nearly 2 years ago that Starbucks illegally retaliated against a group of workers organizing a union in Memphis. The board, also called the NLRB, found Starbucks' conduct so egregious that they took the rare step to ask a court to issue an immediate injunction, allowing the workers to return to the job and continue their organizing. But Starbucks took issue with the NLRB's ability to get a court to issue a preliminary injunction and issued their own legal challenge. In effect, Starbucks is asking the Supreme Court to impose a strict standard for determining when lower courts can issue NLRB-requested injunctions. If the Supreme Court sides with Starbucks, as is likely to be the case, workers could face an even greater uphill battle to pursuing legal recourse for workplace injustices. To better understand the Starbucks v. McKinney case, Monday Morning QB was joined by Daniel Rosenthal, a partner at the law firm James & Hoffman, which participated in the Supreme Court case by filing a brief on behalf of Starbucks workers. Rosenthal began by explaining the lengthy legal process workers face when they seek to protect their rights.
It's harder than it should be. The process can take some time, and there are also some weaknesses in terms of the remedies that are available when workers face that sort of retaliation. So basically, the way the process works in workplaces that are governed by the National Labor Relations Act, like Starbucks, when a worker or a union believes that there's been some violation of the worker's rights or the union's rights, such as, for example, firing an employee who is engaged in union organizing in a retaliatory way, that worker can file a charge with the National Labor Relations Board, the NLRB. It will be investigated. That process can take some time, involving interviewing the workers involved, giving the employer a chance to provide its position on what happened. If the investigators believe that there is some merit to the complaint that was made, they'll often give the employer a chance to settle that case. But if the employer's not interested in that, or there isn't sort of a mutually agreeable set of terms, then the NLRB will issue a complaint. And that is sort of the formal start to the process, but even getting to that point can take quite a while. And then from there, there can be discovery and then eventually a hearing before an administrative law judge. The hearings can take some time as well. And then afterwards, the administrative law judge will issue a decision. Usually they're very thorough, provide a lot of details and provide a remedy, but they don't really have any effect on their own. They're more sort of a recommendation that then has to go to the National Labor Relations Board, the presidentially appointed board. You know, both sides, the employer, the union, have the chance to make objections. And that process can take quite some time. And then eventually the board will make a decision. But even that, at that point, the board's decision is not enforceable on its own. It doesn't have legal effect. It has to be submitted to a court. And again, the employer has a chance to make objections. The union does as well. And so finally, after all that process, there could finally be a enforceable, legally effective order. And it takes quite some time. And I alluded to the remedies. Usually what will be granted if, let's say, a worker was fired in violation of the law, would be reinstatement, back pay, and often some sort of posting to employees to advise them that the employer has violated the law and that they have these rights. What's not available is things that people might think of in other types of lawsuits, like emotional distress damages, punitive damages, attorney's fees. So sometimes it can feel a little bit like the employee hasn't truly, or the union hasn't truly been made whole for what has happened.
So it's my understanding that this Supreme Court case of Starbucks v. McKinney is centered on a few legal concepts, including the notion of a preliminary injunction and what kinds of criteria are used to determine whether a preliminary injunction needs to be ordered by a court. There's also notions of harm and particularly irreparable harm. Can you spend a little bit of time defining some of these legal concepts for listeners and especially talk about why certain criteria need to be met for a court to issue a preliminary injunction in a worker-employer dispute?
So this arises from a federal law, the National Labor Relations Act, which is a law that protects employees engaged in union organizing and other collective action. And it sets up the process, which we've talked a little about, to decide if an employer has acted illegally and to provide a remedy for that. It also recognizes that the process can take some time and that there's often a need to provide some sort of resolution before the final outcome of this process. And so it addresses that through a section which is known as Section 10J of the National Labor Relations Act. And that section basically says that the NLRB, they'll have the power, once it's issued a complaint against an employer, to go to the court and say that, you know, we filed a complaint. We believe there is unlawful conduct here, and we need a preliminary resolution prior to the final outcome of the process. And just as an example, the reason why that's so important is that union organizing campaigns are fragile, and they can be easily thrown off course when an employer does something like Starbucks did in this case, of firing 5 out of 6 of the members of the union organizing committee. And that can create a lot of fear among other employees. So if it were the case that the only remedy for that would take place after the entire NLRB process, which can take years, it would be very problematic, because by the time you got to that outcome, it would often be very hard to resuscitate the effort to organize employees within a store, and the momentum of the campaign would be lost. So the law recognizes that there's this need in some cases, and they're pretty rare actually in terms of how often this power is actually used, but in some cases there's a need for this preliminary relief. So you asked about the term preliminary injunction. The term that's used within the statute itself is temporary relief. And basically, those terms mean that a court is providing some remedy temporarily prior to the final outcome of a legal process. The concept of irreparable harm, which is not specifically referenced within the statute, but is something that courts often talk about, is considered an important factor in whether temporary relief is appropriate. And basically what it means is that there's some harm that's taken place that needs to be addressed right away because it's not possible to effectively address it later on. So the example I was just talking about an organizing campaign where, you know, a remedy 2 years later is not going to be effective in terms of really addressing what the harm was. So that is an example of irreparable harm.
Listening to the questions asked by justices during oral arguments on Tuesday, it clearly seems the court is going to side with Starbucks in the sense that the NLRB's, I suppose, preferred criteria for temporary relief will be set aside. I'm curious if you can speak to the consequences of this decision, both legally, you know, in terms of how courts and the NLRB make legal determinations, and practically for workers on the ground. Does this meaningfully change how organizing is conducted?
I think the consequences will depend a lot on not only what outcome the court reaches, but also on exactly how they write their decision. What the NLRB is asking the court to do, and other parties, unions, and others have asked the court to do, is to explain that really, regardless of how the standard is explained, whether it's the standard that Starbucks is asking for or the one the NLRB prefers, that the court should keep a couple things in mind when evaluating these matters. The first is that the court should not conduct an overly critical examination of the NLRB's claims in the case, because at this point, the NLRB has already thoroughly investigated and issued a complaint, determined that there's a really good reason to believe there was unlawful conduct and that a remedy is needed, and that a court needs to give some credit to that determination and the expertise that the National Labor Relations Board brings to that inquiry. Whereas Starbucks would like the Supreme Court, to say that courts should not give any real consideration to the expertise of the National Labor Relations Board or their views, and the court should really essentially start from scratch and conduct its own, you know, full critical analysis of the evidence. The problem with that is that it extends the process, and it means that a lot more work has to go into it on the side of the parties and the court, and that it will potentially, in some cases, lead to these preliminary injunctions being denied when they really should be granted. The other aspect of it is whether the type of harm that the NLRB has focused on in terms of harm to organizing campaigns, that sort of thing, whether that's going to be sufficient to grant one of these temporary injunctions. And Starbucks would like, I think, the court to really limit what types of harm should be seen as sufficient. So the decision could have a real impact on the legal standard. And that could in turn have a real impact on the frequency with which these injunctions are granted. And that is significant because these are really important in the cases where they're sought. But we should keep in mind, and I've alluded to this, that 10J injunctions are very rare, actually. In the most recent year in which we have data, there were 14 10J injunctions sought, and that can be compared to nearly 20,000 charges filed with the NLRB and more than 700 complaints issued by the NLRB. So they're seeking these temporary injunctions in very few cases compared to the overall extent of issues with illegal conduct by employers. And some people would say that they should be doing it a lot more often. The fact is they're very selective about it. And hopefully those cases where they choose to pursue it, it will still often be granted with the same or similar frequency to which it's granted now. But that could be impacted negatively by the Supreme Court decision.
Obviously, this is a really complex topic, but I wanted to give you a chance to provide closing thoughts if you have any.
Well, I guess the only other thing I would add would be to talk a little bit about the clients that my colleagues and I represented in the Supreme Court. We submitted a brief on behalf of 12 Starbucks workers. All 12 of these workers were very active in union organizing, and all of them were disciplined by Starbucks, most of them actually fired. And their belief, which in many cases has already been validated by the National Labor Relations Board, is that they were treated illegally and in retaliation for their union organizing. All of these workers were drawn to the idea of union representation for different reasons. One of them that we talk about in the brief had a colleague who was sexually assaulted by a Starbucks supervisor, and the police eventually arrested the supervisor, but instead of firing that supervisor who was arrested for sexual assault, Starbucks fired the worker who complained about it, and then told the other workers at the store that they should get over that issue. This is an example of treatment that many of our clients experienced in Starbucks. And so they banded together with their colleagues to advocate for better working conditions and a union, and then suffered a discipline or termination from Starbucks. And that had a really massive negative impact on them as individuals, and also in some cases on the organizing effort in their stores. As an example, one of our clients who we call AC lost her job after she engaged in union organizing. And after that, she had to have her children leave her home and move in with their father because she just couldn't afford to take care of them anymore. So these are the examples that we offered in our brief to illustrate to the court why it's important to issue these sort of temporary injunctions in some cases in order to protect union organizing efforts. And so we hope that that will be recognized in some way by the Supreme Court's decision.
And can I ask briefly what the status of, I assume there were charges filed with the NLRB. What's the status of those for those workers that you are representing?
That's correct. All of our clients had charges filed with the NLRB. Several of them, the NLRB has already found a merit to their charges, both by issuing a complaint and then by having an administrative law judge hold a hearing, hear evidence, and then rule in their favor. But the process, as we've discussed, is a long one and requires a lot of steps after that, which have not happened. So most of the Starbucks workers who we represented in our brief have not yet received a final remedy or final outcome of their cases.
That's Daniel Rosenthal, partner at the law firm James and Hoffman. To learn more, visit jamhoff.com. That's jamhoff.com. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
Protest against Israel's war in Gaza continued over the weekend on college and university campuses across the United States, and that included Kent State University in Ohio, where hundreds of pro-Palestinian demonstrators gathered on Saturday to protest the war in Gaza and demand that the university divest from Israel. It was an unusually solemn occasion, as protesters at Kent State were also marking a tragic anniversary. On May 4, 1970, four students were shot dead by the National Guard during a Vietnam War protest at Kent State. The massacre inspired Neil Young to write what would soon become a protest anthem. Here's Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young performing Ohio.
Soldiers and Nixon's coming. Rogers and Nixon's coming. We're finally on our own. This summer I hear the drumming. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. For dead in Ohio. I'm in dead in Ohio. I'm in war. For dead in Ohio. 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 For dead in Ohio.
And that's our show for today. Rest in peace and power, Askia Muhammad. Thanks to our engineers. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
And I'm Sue Goodwin. Thank you for listening and supporting Jazz and Justice Radio in the nation's capital.
Parlor is the original women's radio collective. Wednesdays from 3 to 5 p.m., the best music divas on radio at 89.3 FM and sophiesparlor.blogspot.com.
The D.C. Music Census is now live. Led by the D.C. Commission on the Arts and Humanities, the DC Music Census is an initiative that collects data from music industry professionals about the DMV's music economy, allowing the district to make informed decisions in supporting the music ecosystem. The census is anonymous and designed for anyone working within the music industry. Members of the music community may take the census by visiting dcmusiccensus.org. That's dcmusiccensus.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Babe, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobe on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50, and there are only 100 tickets for this VIP event. Secure your tickets to the Jazz Happy Hour.
Tickets are available at Eventbrite. When in Eventbrite, please search WPFW Tacoma Station. We're looking forward to celebrating you on Sunday, May 26th from 5 until 9 p.m. at Tacoma Station.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for jazz and justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You'd be so nice to come home to. You'd be so nice. Bye.
Economic, political, and military decisions in Washington, D.C. impact this entire country and world. And yet corporate media offers few facts, history, or people's voices about these important issues impacting our lives. I'm Esther Ivarum. Welcome to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, here on WPFW 89.3, Fridays at 10 a.m. We cover local, national, and international social justice activism, including those who come to D.C. from across the nation or from across the world to speak truth to power. Whether it's the war machine, climate change, the movement for black lives, healthcare, education, the economy, housing, voting, corporate power, immigration, criminal justice, or environmental justice. Check out On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, Fridays at 10 a.m., here on your station for jazz and justice.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. On Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalamar. But two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Sego, this is John Kane, and I want to invite you to join me right here on WPFW on Fridays at 2 p.m. for Let's Talk Native. I will deliver guests and commentary each